So this series, we're exploring the theme of mindfulness, especially as it's communicated in the Satipatthana Sutta, which is one of the discourses that the Buddha gave. It's one of the classic discourses which lays out a very pragmatic way of engaging with our experience, the whole area of mindfulness. And Sangha actually gives a kind of commentary on it in this book, Living with Awareness. I say it's a kind of commentary. This book is distilled out of a seminar that he gave about the sutta. This book here, Satipatthana, by a guy called Anālio, this is a more rigorous point-by-point commentary. I strongly suspect that Vajradeva will say more about both of these books next week, so I won't say more about them now, but I have just laid them out in the bookshop so you can have a look-see if you like. A few years ago now, I was co-leading a retreat with Karmala Shila, the Total Immersion Retreat, which is, I'll just give a quick plug for the Buddhafield Total Immersion. It's a month-long meditation retreat, mostly in silence. Camping. It's a fantastic way of being on retreat. You're really there in contact with the you're just part of the environment here, and the whole practice is geared towards settling into nature, really. And the theme was the Satipatthana Sutta, so we took the whole month to go into the sutta quite thoroughly. And I was co-leading it also with Maitri Devi, who some of you might know from Taraloka. And she created this amazing shrine, this nature shrine. Well, apart from one or two rupas, it's just made out of material from the river and from the field. And there's this, I don't even know why she did it actually, but there's this sort of backdrop she created out of strings of thread through which she wove twigs. So she created this kind of cloth made out of string and twig. And it struck me the whole thing was amazing, but it struck me as a really good image for what we're trying to do in mindfulness practice. The image of a cloth as a whole, I think, is quite helpful. So a cloth, I've never woven, whatever you say. Some people might be able to correct me, but my understanding is that when you weave, you have these long straight threads called the warp, and through the warp you thread the weft. So the weft is the thread that goes in and out through the warp threads. So long straight threads and the in and outy threads, the weft. And I think there's something about this image for me in practice as a whole, really. It's not just mindfulness practice, practice as a whole. We've got these two dimensions to it. There's this sort of directionality. We've got this idea of where we're trying to go, where we're trying to get to. We've got this idea of a goal. It might be a short-term goal. It might be, you know, try to follow my breath for the next breath. You know, it might be quite a short-term goal. It might be enlightenment or bust, but there's some sort of idea of intentionality, this sort of forward-going movement, which is a bit like this warp, it's a bit like these sort of long straight threads. And then there's what's actually happening. There's the reality of the moment as it's unfolding, which might be very different. It might be, here I am nodding off, or here I am completely away in cloud cuckoo land. And both are important. Being able to meet our experience exactly as we find it is really important, and having some sense of what we're trying to do with our experience, so to speak, is important. If all we've got is the warp, if all we've got is this idea of where we're trying to get to, and we're not actually in contact with where we are, then that's kind of ungrounded idealism, you could say. And if all we've got is where we're actually at. I mean, that's not a terrible thing, but or maybe an animal or a baby is exactly where they're at. You know, it's completely present, but it's not really sort of very alive or intelligent. So, but if you've got both those things woven together, then you've got yourself a cloth. So it's that sort of cloth that we're trying to weave in this practice. So where I'm trying to sort of build to in this is and I was given the brief of talking about the first two chapters, or maybe not quite the first two chapters. There's two chapters in here called Remembering and Goal Setting. So that's these two dimensions I'm trying to talk about. These chapters, Remembering and Goal Setting, are kind of glosses on two Pali words, sati and sampajanya. And in the sutra, in fact, these two words are combined into one, sati sampajanya, and have two slightly different connotations. Sati is the word that's usually translated as mindfulness. It literally comes from a word meaning memory, so it's sometimes translated as recollection or recollectedness. Sometimes translated as attentiveness or attention. So it's sort of, in a way, remembering just to be present. I think of this as the sort of the breadth dimension of the present moment. There's all sorts of different aspects of our present moment that we can attend to. So, for example, there's the body. We can tune into the body in all sorts of different ways. You know, there's lots of different aspects of the body we can tune into. You know, the sensations of sitting and how our limbs are composed. And, you know, I don't have to go through it. We'll have one session just looking at the body, in fact. And, of course, the breath is part of the body. There's our feelings. There's the feeling tone of this present moment. Again, we'll be going into this a little bit later on. There's the mind state, the emotional tone and the ethical tone of our mind. That's all part of this present moment. Very significant aspect of this present moment. Because that's what determines the karmic import, the karmic weight of our behaviour is the ethical tone of our mind. And then there's other people around us. They're all part of this present moment as well, and the environment that we're in. So there's all these different aspects of this present moment that can come under sati. Sati, or mindfulness, has been popularized, I'd say. It's been made much better known through the work of Jon Kabat-Zinn. And he's got a definition which has become a bit of a sort of, I don't know, it's probably the best known definition of sati I've come across. So he says, mindfulness is awareness that arises through paying attention on purpose in the present moment, non-judgmentally. So it's got these different qualities to it. It's paying attention on purpose in the present moment, non-judgmentally. So the non-judgmentally bit is significant, because it's bringing to mind, it's a sort of neutral faculty in a way. That sati, in this sense, is sort of neutral. It's just this quite... It brings a little bit of, if you like, distance, although distance isn't the best metaphor, really. It brings a bit of space to our awareness so that we can watch what's happening without, at this stage, getting involved in it, if you like. Which means that we can suspend habitual reactions to our experience in the present moment. If we jump in a bit too quickly with trying to fix our experience, then we're quite likely to be coming from a place of reactivity. Maybe we're a bit averse to our experience, you know. So let's say we've found ourselves drifting off again, and it's like, there can be a bit of a sort of aversion build up there. Or here I am sleepy, and it's like, I don't like being sleepy. I want to be awake. If we can sort of bring this quality of sati, which, well, Analia, just to give you another take on it, he says, is an alert but receptive equanimous observation. So if we can do that, then we can start already to unravel some of our habitual reactions and give ourselves enough time and space to notice in more detail what's actually happening. So there's a lot that arises out of all that, but I think that'll start becoming more apparent as time goes on. That's not to say that mindfulness... Well, it's not to say that when we're being mindful, we never try and do anything about our experience, because mindfulness can also interact with other faculties in our... with other spiritual faculties. So, you know, we can also make efforts. There's, you know, we bring balanced effort to our experience. But I think there's a value in having an attitude that mindfulness is this sort of first point of contact where we don't try and change anything. It's sort of not interfering. And then on the basis of the ability to hold our experience without interference, then a more wise response can come. So, as I say, this is it's a very, very important faculty. I haven't done my research on this one, but in terms of lists in which it appears, good Buddhist lists in which it appears, I think it's probably up there with the best of them. You'll find sati, mindfulness, appearing in loads and loads of different Buddhist lists. And the Buddha talks about it loads and loads. It's the central faculty, for example, of the five spiritual faculties. It's the faculty which lets us balance all the other faculties. So, for example, it lets us balance energy and a more receptive quality. It's through having mindfulness that we can sort of work out how much effort to apply, for example. Yes, so it's a really important faculty. But if it's the only one we had, it's not quite it. Yes, because I imagine a baby can be very present and non-judgmental about their experience in a certain kind of way. So to fill out the Buddhist understanding of mindfulness in the broader sense, we need to bring in the quality of sampajanya, which is this sort of warp I was talking about, this sense of directionality. In fact, it's not just directionality forwards, it's also directionality backwards. It's a whole sense of context that we're in. It's a whole history that we bring with us, and it's the sense of where we're going with our history. It's the sense of, in a way, being part of a Dharma flow. I'll read a little something from Sangharakshita here. So he's talking about how it is to give our life story. Telling our life story is something that we quite often tend to do when we're trying to get to know each other better within the Sangha. He says, even after hearing about the lives of ordinary Buddhists, or even hearing about the lives of ordinary Buddhists can leave one with a distinct impression that their progress towards the spiritual path was inevitable, as though there was a goal implicit in everything they did, a goal that gradually became clearer to them as they experienced more of life and realize what they really wanted to do and be. You might not realize the path your life is taking until you look back on it, but when you do, you become aware of your purpose. It might seem uncannily as though your life has had a direction of its own, independent of your own conscious volition. As that direction emerges into consciousness, with the arising of some degree of clear comprehension, it is intensified and you can pursue it even more vigorously. The Sāntra uses slightly different language. He uses this language of a Dharma current. He says if we look back at our life, we can sort of, in a way, recognize and tap into this Dharma current, which is a sort of non-egotistical flow in our being. It just seems to be carrying us along, almost sort of against our wishes at times. And if we can touch that Dharma flow, then we can, it's as if our life becomes about cooperating with it. It's not about some sort of headstrong, this is where I'm going. It's more like, how can I cooperate with this flow that my life is taking me on, this sort of deeper current of my life? So this is something about the quality of sampajanya. I'll say a bit more about the word. Sometimes translated as clear comprehension. This is the word that Sangharakshita uses, clear comprehension. Not a bad word, because sam means coming together, like com in comprehension. Pajanya is related to the word you might have come across, prajna or panya, which means wisdom. So it's something about sort of this coming together, and it's got clarity about it. So clear comprehension is quite a good word. Sometimes translated as mindfulness of purpose. So yes, there's this sense of having an idea of sort of where we're going, what our purpose is. In any moment, it could be right now the purpose is to, you know, deliver a comprehensible talk. Or yes, it could be anything up to enlightenment. Subhuti translates it as intelligent awareness. So that brings in this whole aspect of sensitive to the context that we're in. So Subhuti, this is a disciple of Sangharakshita, he gives the example that, a classic way people talk about mindfulness practices, washing up the dishes, you know, washing up the dishes very mindfully. And he says, that's all very well, but if the dishes have to be washed up by a certain time, you know, if you've got to get off and do something else, then you also need this intelligent awareness of the context you're in. You know, there's a certain degree of urgency to washing up the dishes. So there's this intelligence that's in sampajanya. I'll give you another little quote from Bhante, I think, here. To live with clarity of intention and unity of purpose suggests not only an appreciation of cause and effect, but also the moral sensitivity that is fundamental to true individuality. When you lose clear comprehension of purpose, you haven't just lost your mindfulness. There is a lapse of your moral character, a break in the continuity of your being. So far as the implicit goal of growth and self-knowledge is concerned, it is a kind of lapse into unconsciousness. And in this state of spiritual unconsciousness, your instincts and habitual patterns of greed and aversion will be likely to take over. So he's bringing in here a kind of an ethical quality about mindfulness here. He's saying that if we've really got this sense of of our spiritual nature, if you like, then to lose our continuity of purpose is to lose a certain ethical standing, if you like. And he also mentioned this idea of being aware of ourselves as unfolding within the framework of conditionality. In other words, seeing how our actions keep on unfolding in the way that, in who we become, moment by moment, day by day, year by year. So this, and I said there's a sense of past as well as future. We can have a sense of ourselves unfolding through time, depending on our state of mind and on our actions. So this probably gives quite a broad sense of what mindfulness can be, I hope. It's not just about what's happening in the present moment, even across the whole range of possible body, feeling, mind, so the outside world, other people. It's also having a sense of ourselves as this being with a spiritual path unfolding through time. But that's not the end of it, I don't think. So that gives us our cloth, which is a sort of two-dimensional image. But I'd like also to bring in a depth dimension here, a third dimension to mindfulness, which is really a drawing out more deeply what Sampajanya means. So if we talk about clear comprehension, it's not just being intellectually acute. It also brings in the dimension of wisdom, wisdom in its fullest sense. So what do I mean about this? So I'll take us sideways way around here. So a lot of our practice is probably geared towards trying to improve ourselves in one way or another, trying to become more mindful or trying to become more kind or more sensitive, or all sorts of different ways in which we are working to transform ourselves in this sort of warp dimension, you know, into the future, trying to over time become more and more like a Buddha, you could say. More and more satisfying state of being. More skillful, more still, more expansive, whatever it is. I would like to suggest that there's the ultimate satisfaction is to be found not in some future state, so to speak, but in the depth dimension of the present moment, the depth dimension of what's unfolding at any time, which is, in fact, all we've ever got. And the depth dimension is understanding in, it's not so much sort of more and more minuscule detail, but it's with less and less obscuration of vision. What's actually happening? And this is a bit difficult to talk about, really. But what we're talking about is the distinction between samatha practice, the practice of sort of concentration on the one hand, and vipassana practice, which is this clear seeing. And to try and just sketch in a few aspects of what that might mean, I'll just draw on one list, the list of the three lakshanas. The three lakshanas, the three marks of conditioned existence, which starts to, it's where we start to see our moment-to-moment experience not as a series of lumpy things interacting occasionally, but it sees our experience unfolding continually. So we're talking here about impermanence. It sees that there's no sort of lumpy things to change, that everything is a process of change, in particular ourself. Ourself is this endless process of change. And we're talking here about anatta, about the lack of any sort of fixed essence to our being, and in fact the lack of any fixed essence to anything we can find. And then there's the aspect of dukkha, that until we actually settle into this kind of vision, our habitual way of relating to the world in this sort of lumpy way is going to be rather unsatisfying. So I'm not going to try and expand all that any further, because it's that's quite a big subject, and that's going to be the where we're going with towards the end of this series. This is the way of this is the final aspect of the Satipatthana Sutta, is looking at reality. But I just want to mention that dimension, the depth dimension. So we've got one dimension, which is the present moment, another dimension, which is our context through time, where we've come from, where we're off to, and then there's the depth dimension in the moment, if you like. So it might seem like quite a lot to juggle all of this, and in a way it is. It's our whole experience, if you like. So it is quite a bit to juggle. It's one of the purposes of sampajanya, this clear understanding. One of the functions of it is to know where best and how best to direct our attention. And this is the art, really, of the spiritual life, is just to know how to attend, what quality and what object to bring our mind onto. There's not really a whole lot else we can do, really. So sometimes it's we just need to bring ourselves back to the present moment, back to our body, and stay anchored in the body. That's probably a lot of what we need to do most of the time, really, is just root ourselves back in the present moment in the body, simply because so much of the time we're not there. Sometimes we might need to apply a bit more effort to keep on doing that in quite a sort of concerted way, keep on bringing it back to the breath. Sometimes we might need to open up and just see what's there, really feel into ourselves in a very open kind of way. So this is, I want to bring it back really to how we started off with the lead into the meditation practice there. I don't know if it's still current, but a while ago there was a meditation acronym. Mnemonic acronym. Piper. I don't know how many people have come across Piper. It's one of the sort of five-stage thing to go into. It's a little checklist to go through as you start meditating. P for posture, so just settling into your posture. I for introspection, how do I feel? P for purpose, where am I off to? E for enthusiasm, do I really want to get there? R for resolve, yes I do! So it's all, never quite clicked with me at the time, but hopefully it gives you a sense of both these dimensions, or the sort of two dimensions of the cloth. We start off with physical posture and our internal emotional landscape. This is where am I right now? How am I right now? Without changing anything, and then establishing this sense of purpose, enthusiasm, resolve. It's all this sort of intentionality it's trying to connect with. So you may not use Piper in exactly that sort of format, but that's the basic kind of cloth we're trying to establish as we enter into a meditation practice, or any kind of practice really. So what I'd like to do is a bit of walking meditation, just to round off what I've said. But before that, are there any questions or comments that arise out of what I've just said? Yes.
Is mindfulness and recollection the same thing?
Um, What do you think? That's always a good answer, isn't it?
When I meditate, I mostly forget to be mindful. Right. And I remember. And I think that point of remembering that I've strayed away somewhere is recollection.
Yeah, that's right. That's it, isn't it? I mean, recollecting oneself to be mindful is, in a way, all we can do. When we got lost, all we can do is hope that at some stage we remember to be mindful again. And when we recollect ourselves, then we're mindful. So in a way, they're the same thing, but they're sort of different aspects of the same thing, you could say. Yeah. I think it's also worth saying that these two dimensions I was talking about, they're not always very united in individuals. I think it's possible to be quite strong in one and not in the other. And I remember reading the biography of Shinro Suzuki, a Zen practitioner, a very fine Zen practitioner who was quite noted for completely forgetting what he was meant to be doing, you know, getting on the train to go to conduct a wedding and then forgetting where he's going to and missing the wedding, this kind of thing. So it's kind of interesting how people can be very strong in some aspects and not necessarily in others at times. Yeah, anything else?
The idea of the thread running through your life bringing you to where you are now.
Yeah.
Are we looking back as Buddhists, ticking off certain things, going, oh, well, that happened, that's part of my thread to become a Buddhist, and looking back on it with hindsight, because we are now Buddhists?
What's the concern there?
That it's a bit of looking back with hindsight rather than there being any thread particularly.
Yeah. Yeah, if I sort of cut you through the middle, I probably won't find the thread. So it is a kind of what am I saying? I'm not trying to make a doctrine out of this. It's more like myth. It's like connecting to the myth of our life, the story of our life. And we've all got a story to our life. And it's maybe trying to find a more helpful story to our life.
But it could have just as easily gone off on another path.
Maybe. It's a bit imponderable, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah. Yeah, because we only lead one life, so it's
where we've arrived, so
yeah,
all things have come together so that we arrive where we are now.
Yeah, yeah.
We've only got one journey at the moment, so there's no way of knowing.
Yeah, and it's a sort of feeling thing, I think. It's rather than a sort of an analytical thing. And maybe it's a sort of a faith-confidence thing as well. I think if we believe our life to be a series of random coincidences, which might be true, and I've got no way of proving that, it's probably not as helpful a myth of our life as something else which feels a bit more, emotionally connecting. But, you know, you can't force it. If it doesn't feel that way, you can't force it. Yeah.
You can't really have random happenings because of conditionality.
Well, yes. Well, yeah. Yeah, that's also true. But I suppose I'm just trying to sort of... Vajradevi, some of you might have been here when Vajradevi led a meditation called, what did she call it? A river. She was using an image of a river and some of the significant features through our life, some of the significant events of our life that sort of feel like we've been on this sort of river that's brought us here. As I say, I don't want to force it, but it might kind of it might ring true for some people. Okay, so let's leave it there, and I invite you, and I'll explain what we're going to do once we're all stood up, but we'll have to do the clearing the space first, So let's take a few minutes to mindfully and silently clear the decks.